just, yep.
Yep. Cool.
There we go. So for those who don't know, I'm Pam Leadbeater, and registered nurse who's worked in aged care for half a lifetime. So, and especially around dementia, I've done a lot of very early assessment right through and worked in aged care as well, in nursing homes, in the community. So I've had quite a lot to do with dementia and cognitive impairment. So we're going to have a look at today understanding dementia and healthy brain ageing. Just so everyone knows, we're just recording here. So if you want to ask me a question, as long as you know that we are recording it, if that's okay with everyone. Okay, let's get started. And I've also brought some resources over here. If you want to just take one book, this is the best one over there. So it's really comprehensive. It's got all the information that you would ever need, and it's a really well put together book. But there's also other things over there that you might want to take home with you as well. So let's get started before it decides to turn itself off again. So the human brain is a highly complex organ, and it controls everything that we do. So it's pretty important for us. So the brain itself, there's different parts of the brain. So we actually have two hemispheres split down the middle, and either side, so we've got two frontal lobes here. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what those lobes are responsible for in this talk this morning, this afternoon. So frontal lobes in the very front here, parietal lobes up here, occipital lobes down here over our ears, temporal lobes at the back, temporal lobes over the ears, occipital lobes at the back, and of course then it goes down to the brainstem and cerebellum down the bottom of the brain there. So our temporal lobes, it's over our ears, are responsible for our memory for experiences, so all through our life, our experiences, our memory for facts. It's also responsible for understanding speech, and they're our filing system. So when with our memories, that's where we file our memories, in these lobes here over our ears. So our parietal lobe functions. In our parietal lobes, they look after language, speech, reading, calculations, spatial knowledge. So for those who don't understand spatial knowledge, or spatial awareness it might be as well, that means that I know that I pick up my drink bottle like this, and I know that I'm going to put it on the table here. But for those people who have some damage in that lobe, in the parietal lobe, and in that area of spatial awareness, it would be that they might pick up their teacup, and instead of putting it on the table here, they'll actually miss the table. So it's sort of, you can often describe it as a bit of looking at someone and they look a bit clumsy. That could be something that they have. That doesn't happen to everyone. Of course, it depends on where the damage is done in their brain. And also the parietal lobes are responsible for our movement. So the way that we walk or run, or the way that we move our arms. Our occipital lobes are responsible for our visual perception and our recognition of faces. So when we see things out here, so I can see all of you here in this room, what our brain actually does is take that vision right through to the occipital lobes at the back here. So then it's processed and comes forward to the front of the brain. So the limbic system, it wasn't on that picture of the brain there, but the limbic system is deep inside the brain, and it's responsible for consciousness, for sleep, for appetite, and for emotions. So if something's going wrong in that limbic system, and you might find that people can do one of two things around their appetite. This is just an example. So they might not eat not want to eat, not actually get the feeling that they need to eat, or they might eat everything. And for those people who are caring for someone who has the appetite to eat all the time, often they need to actually store things away from in front of that person, because instead of eating, we would say have two or three biscuits or one, they would eat the whole packet. So that is when the brain's affected in that area in the limbic system. So our frontal lobes are our managers of our brain, so really important to look after these. When I do talks to younger ones, I say you've got to wear your helmet, look after your brain, make sure you don't hit those frontal lobes, because the frontal lobes are responsible. They actually receive all the information from the rest of the brain, and they make plans and decisions. They're about how we know how to write, how we organise ourselves, how we get things started. So the frontal lobes are actually responsible for us getting up in the morning, knowing that we're going to have a shower, get dressed, have breakfast, get to somewhere at a certain time. So if there's something going wrong with that, you might find someone, if that's affected, you might find someone who just wants to sit in the chair all day. They don't want to do anything else. That's them. That's what they will do. Your frontal lobes are always also responsible for deciding who does what and when. So as I said, like getting to appointments on time, knowing where you've got to get to and those things. It receives feedback from the other centres of the brain. Also about making judgments about how we're going. I remember one particular 95-year-old, his son came in to see us and said, Dad was perfectly okay, and managing at home on his own, totally independent. All of a sudden, he just sold his house. And he goes, well, that's probably all right if he wanted to sell his house, but he hadn't planned where he was going to go after had sold his house. So he was then set, and that was the first beginning signs of something going wrong with that gentleman. Also, the frontal lobes are responsible for how we respond. So sometimes in people who've got some problems happening there, what we'll find is that, you know, we all have a social skill about, you know, not saying terrible things about people when we're out. I actually had, my mum had dementia, and towards the end we would take her out and she would be saying to people, you know, you'd take her out for a morning tea or a coffee or something, and she'd be talking about the lady next door who, isn't she incredibly fat? And I'd go, oh, Mum. And, you know, Mum was always a really lovely person, and you would never hear her say something like that. But all of a sudden she was, you know, saying all these inappropriate things. So sometimes that happens as well. So it depends on where the damage is being done in the brain, so, and what lobes. And I'm going to talk a little bit now about some of the things that I'll talk first about the normal functioning of the brain, and then I'll talk about about dementia and the things that change our brain like that. So as we age, normal changes to brain function occur. So our brain's probably at its best functioning in our mid-20s. So after that, it's kind of downhill, not too badly downhill, but it's for us slower information processing. So as we age, we've got lots more memories, we've had lots more experiences, and we've got all these experiences and memories stuck in our filing cabinet here. So it's much harder to access that information because there's a lot more information. Our young brains in our 20s, we haven't had 80 years of experience. So our filing cabinet's a bit more full as we age, and it's a bit harder to process information. And we have increased forgetfulness, all of us. So that's a normal ageing thing. For all of us that, you know, I, in my 20s, on the surgical ward, could remember names and doctors and diagnoses, and now I actually can't go anywhere without my something written in my phone or in my diary or anything like that. So that's just normal day-to-day changes in our brain. The good thing about it as we get old is that we have improved vocabulary. So there's always a bit of a bonus. So some common memory difficulties, we might forget names. Is anybody here forget names? Yeah. That's normal. We might lose things. We might forget things. We might forget directions sometimes. And we might forget appointments. So that's often what all of us experience. And factors that can affect our memory and our thinking without it being dementia is that, you know, when you're tired, you don't respond, your brain doesn't work as well, you're not as fast, you can't do the things that you'd like to do. So all of these things will impact our memory and our thinking. Feeling stress is a big one, can really mess up our memory for things. Grief, pain, anxiety, depression, all these things can affect our memory. Some medications, we were just talking before I started that some people's memory is quite a bit worse if they're on, say, really heavy pain medications or antipsychotics or antidepressants and some like can really affect some people and their memory. So nutrient deficiencies can affect memory too. So I don't know if you've heard about B12, but I've actually had people who've been really deficient in B12 and it's really affected their memory so badly that they thought they had dementia. When they went off to the doctor and he then gave them the B12 injections, they were back to normal. So something like that, it's important as we go along to make sure that your doctor's checking all those things. So even dehydration can affect how our memory works. Hormonal changes, what do they call that, baby brain? And what happens to some women with the menopause? Infections and acute illness can affect our memory. And, of course, dementia certainly can affect our memory. So 5 simple steps to maximise your brain health. So it's basically about looking after your whole body and your brain. So looking after your heart, being physically active, mentally challenging your brain. So it's good to be doing some crosswords or something that will help with your brain. Reading, going out socially, that's really important to stay socially connected. Following a healthy diet. The latest really is a lot of the specialists are saying now a Mediterranean diet, which is kind of fish, meat, fruit, vegetables. And what I said before, enjoying social activity is really important for our brain health. No questions? So it's not normal to experience memory and thinking changes that significantly affect our everyday life. So I'm going to go into now talking about dementia. So when our memory and thinking, look, all those things that I've said can change any time for us if we're not feeling well, if we're stressed or we haven't had enough sleep, you know, our memory's not going to work as well as it usually does. But when we actually then have problems with functioning day to day with the changes that are happening, then we have to go and have a look at why is that. So dementia is an umbrella term for a combination of symptoms that can include memory, thinking, language, and behaviour. There's actually over 100 different diseases and things that cause dementia. So I'm going to talk about the more common ones here this afternoon, but there's certainly lots of things that go under that umbrella of what we call dementia. And in some people, It's memory and thinking. And then in other people in those early days, it might not be about their memory at all. It's actually about their behaviours changing. So it's not, because we often think of dementia just being about memory, but it's not always just about memory. We caused by a range of conditions, I've said that, affects your ability to carry out daily tasks and causes a progressive decline in the way that we think. So our cognitive functioning. So the most causes of dementia are progressive, and these up here are the more common causes. So everybody's probably heard of Alzheimer's disease, yeah. And vascular dementia, maybe or maybe not, I'm going to talk about that. Mixed dementia, so that could be someone could have Alzheimer's disease and a vascular dementia. Lewy body dementia and frontotemporal dementia. So this slide up here shows you, this is actually what happens in Alzheimer's disease. So those are healthy cells on the bottom, in the bottom slide, the healthy brain cells. And the top ones are Alzheimer's disease. So Alzheimer's disease is about plaques, what we call plaques and tangles, that surround the outside of a brain cell, and actually they cause the death of that brain cell. So this is a slice of the brain. I just thought I would put that up so you have a little look at what the brain looks like. And this is preclinical Alzheimer's disease. So with Alzheimer's disease, it can affect different regions within the brain, and what it does is it shrinks and the nerve cells die. So depending on where your damage is done, as to what, relating back to what behaviours you might see or what type of memory loss you might see, some people lose their speech, which is called primary progressive aphasia. So that's a type of Alzheimer's disease as well. So, and sometimes changes can begin 10 or 20 years before symptoms appear. So it's kind of, if you're looking after someone or caring or around someone who has dementia and you finally might get that diagnosis, it might be that you look back and go, oh, there were a couple of indicators that something wasn't quite right, kind of back there, you know, 5 or 10 years ago. And in Alzheimer's disease, memory loss is really the first sign. So, I said in frontotemporal dementia, it might be behavioural changes, but usually with Alzheimer's disease, it's about the memory. So we'll talk a little bit about vascular dementia. So vascular dementia, has anybody heard of TIAs, trans ischemic attacks? Yes. So they're tiny, tiny little infarcts in the brain, like tiny, tiny strokes. And some people can have those without even, you might not even recognise them. So it would be, or it might be just that the person has a little vague moment. Like they're just sitting there and they have this little vague moment and you go, I wonder what's happened to them. And they're just kind of a bit glassy-eyed and sitting there. Sometimes they'll be really tired for that day or the next day. And then you might notice that they're not able to do something in the next 24, 48 hours. And depending on how big that that death of brain cells is, that depends. That then you look at what sort of skills are lost, how they're lost. Now, in Alzheimer's disease, the progression of Alzheimer's disease is just a gentle curve down. So that's the progression. But when someone has vascular dementia, it's often that they have a little event, like a little tiny stroke, and they'll lose a bit of ability, so they'll cruise along. They'll lose a bit. They'll cruise along. And, you know, if they're... I'll talk about some of the things that we can control. But if they're not... If they continue to have events, then they'll lose the skills with those. But if they're well controlled with blood pressure, cholesterol, different things, then they may not... They might cruise along really well and not lose a whole lot of skills. But you can also have Alzheimer's disease and vascular disease together. So the risk with vascular dementia is high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, heart problems, sleep apnea, smoking, being overweight, a family history, and of course, as you get older as well. So we can actually look at some of those risk factors and avoid, well, try and avoid some of them. Like, you know, if you've got high blood pressure, then making sure that you get regularly to your GP, that they've got you on a medication, to that they're monitoring your blood pressure, same with cholesterol, and the same with diabetes. And, you know, if you have sleep apnea, it's really important to have that properly assessed. And if you need to have a sleep apnea machine, then it's a good idea to have one, because it not only affects your brain, but affects all your other organs as well, your heart, your kidneys, liver, all those things. So it's good to have that assessed and properly diagnosed. So frontotemporal dementia, this is a gradual progressive decline in behaviour and or language. So when I talked about those frontal lobes, not so much about memory, more about behaviour and language. You might find that person in the early days, all that you notice is a change in mood and social behaviour. They can either become very social or they can become very withdrawn. They may become quite obsessive and repetitive about things. So they get very stuck on different things. Sometimes the onset can be between 45 and 65 years of age. So anyone who's diagnosed with dementia under the age of 65 is what we call younger onset dementia. And I have, through the years, actually looked after a 32-year-old. That was incredibly sad. Yes, yeah, so she had two little ones and, yeah, it was not good. And we were talking about, before you all came in, that those younger onset dementias often progress quite a bit faster than someone who's, say, got an older age Alzheimer's or something like that. So I've talked about that, repeating phrases over and echoing what others have said. So that's the frontotemporal. So I wanted to talk about, how am I going for time? Okay. Yep. Communication is a really big thing around someone who has dementia or some early signs of it. So how do we communicate? Words are actually only 10% of what, you wouldn't believe it, would you, that words are only 10% of how we communicate. And our tone of voice is 35% and our body language is 55%. So it's really important when you're talking to someone to, you know, be open about, because they'll look at you and go, well, what does this mean? What is she doing? She doesn't look like she's really involved or engaged with me, does she? She's looking like she's a bit grumpy or cranky. And, you know, when you're talking to someone and say you've had a day where someone's not been too well and they've just repeated, and you've just kind of had enough at the end of the day, you have to take a really big, deep breath and go, this is about the disease, not about the person. So it's kind of important, you know, not raising your eyebrows and going, oh, not again, you haven't asked that question again. So there's little tips, we'll talk about those. So some changes you may notice in the person with dementia are that they may have difficulty finding a word or saying a related word instead of the one that is lost. So I do that sometimes, but I usually get it, you know, a little bit later. I go, oh, that was that word. They may be able to understand what you are saying or only be able to grasp part of what you're saying. They may talk fluently but may not make any sense at all. Writing and understanding the written word may deteriorate also. They may be able to talk of the distant past but not of recent events. And we were talking about that too. People, what happens is that, I suppose, when we make memories, it's a bit like the ink pad. So when our ink pad is young, in our 20s, and we do the stamp, we lay down that memory really well, because we've got lots of chemicals in our brain, not too much else fuzzy in there. But as things start to go wrong, as we get older, the ink pad dries out and we can't make as strong a memory. So when there's a disease process and we've got brain cells dying, what happens is that we might not remember that we had a cup of tea 5 minutes ago, but we can certainly remember, you know, some beautiful things about being on the farm or our favourite dog or our favourite grandchild, which we're not supposed to have, those sorts of things. So they're deep in there and they remain intact through the through part of the process. So a really good thing to do is actually sit and reminisce with people. Actually sit and be with where they're at. So if someone's constantly saying, if they think they're in that space, then that's where they are at that moment. And it's good to go back there if it's not causing any stress or anything like that, then it's okay to talk about those things in their earlier days. They may lose the normal social convention of conversation. They can interrupt, ignore other speakers, not respond when spoken to, or become very self-centred. And they may have difficulty expressing emotions appropriately. I run a carer support group in Hervey Bay through the church, and we had a group on Thursday. One of the ladies said, "My husband just there's no emotion." She goes, "That he just sits there. There's nothing anymore. That's gone." And that's quite a difficult thing for her. So we talked about the impact of that particular thing on her. So support groups can be really good things if you're a group person. Sometimes you're not a group person and it's not going to be helpful. But I have about 12 people in my support group, and we meet once a month, and it's valuable, very valuable, because I actually have people who have identified some issues, but there's no diagnosis. And then another couple that have already lost their partners. But they feel like that group gives them what they need, even once a month, to be part of that and be able to talk about how they feel. So we must accept that most of the adjustments have to be made by us. The person who has a diagnosis or early issues with memory or dementia will not be able to change what they're doing. It needs to be about us. So we're the person closest to them or caring for them or even just visiting them, you know, once a week or whatever, then it needs to be about us changing the way that we approach that person. We need to be positive and concentrate on the person's remaining abilities and strengths. Very important to be really positive. And we need to learn how to listen and affirm that person's feelings. Sometimes that's a bit difficult, and some people can have very bad days. But if you can be there, just be there and listen and engage with that person. Did that go? Oh, it's not going to move. Hang on. There we go. Thought I'd lost it. Helpful strategies. So it's speaking clearly and slowly to that person, because remember then they're probably not processing as fast as we are, so more slowly the speech. Making eye contact. And if someone's a real touch person, we are not all touch people, but if they are, it's good to actually have them concentrating on you and maybe just touch a hand or a shoulder or something like that. Just one question at a time. And it's much better to have a yes or no answer at that. Would you like a cup of tea? That's a yes or a no. If you fire away 3 or 4 different questions to a person who's having difficulty processing information, what will happen is that they'll remember the very last little thing that you said, and they won't remember all of this that you've said before that. So don't ever argue. It's important. It's difficult to do sometimes, but they're not going to understand if you argue with them. And validate their feelings. So it's important to have the right environment so you keep the person as independent as possible. And there can be some devices that can be helpful with that. You know, if you think it's a bit of a danger with leaving electricity or gas and things on, then you simply just turn them off. Non-slip mats we were talking about before we started, controls on water heating, security locks, things like that. Everyone has a very different journey, and you can never know how long, what sort of deterioration, what things might go wrong. So we don't know that. So it's important to just, as things come up for you, to seek some advice or to actually problem solve what's going on for them. It's really important to keep familiar objects around where they are. And for those people who like to move furniture around and drawers around, that's not a very good idea. People who are struggling with cognitive issues like to be in familiar environments with where they can find things and know where to go to find things. You might have to label cupboards. You might have to use pictures or words for these people. Like I said, diaries, calendars are good. Whiteboards are good if you're going out and doing something. So that person knows on this particular day we're going out to the doctor on this day or whatever. Their whiteboards are good for that. Some people use calendars as well. But if you're going to get a calendar, get a nice big one with nice big squares so you can write clearly in there. Avoid competing noises. So if you've got the TV on or the radio going and you want to say something to someone or have a conversation with someone who's having some problems, they're not going to be able to focus on you if they've got background noise happening over here. So it's good to turn those off and kind of put yourself in front of that person. If they wear glasses, it's good to have them nice and clean. Hearing aids, if they will wear them. Dentures, also about helping them to speak. And so kind of taking in all of those things about their communication issues. Remain still when you're talking to the person. So not like the gentleman who gave the lectures. He's great, fantastic, but he does an awful lot of moving around and flexing his arms. So someone would probably find that a bit difficult to kind of, what's he over there? And he's over there. He's over there. So still, maintain regular routines and to minimise confusion and assist with communication. If you're actually with someone who has dementia, I wrote this for people in aged care, to not actually go over the top of them. Don't come up behind them because they might not realise that you're there. And if they don't realise you're there, then they might hit out because you'll frighten them, fear them. They mightn't have heard you or something like that. So it's good to actually sit and have eye contact. So sit beside a person or in front of them to communicate. Pattern floors aren't good because often a person with dementia will mistake those for a stair. Or if they've got, if something's black, they'll think it's a hole. That can happen. And also, if everything's all one colour, they might have a bit of difficulty with that. I know that if you've got a meal on a plate, it's good to have the tablecloths a darker colour than to have a lighter coloured plate so that they can actually recognise their food. You can show and touch physical objects for them. You can have pictures, memory aids. Photo albums are wonderful for people. Music, some people really love music. That can be quite calming. Those things can all help with communicating with that person. The greatest gift you can give someone with dementia is your presence. So if you can be there, that's the very best thing that you can do. So any questions about that, what I'm going to do now is just look at how to access information, because what do we do if we think something's going wrong, where do we go? So the first step is to talk to your GP. Sometimes that's quite difficult because the person may not recognise that anything is going wrong. And in a lot of cases, I don't know what the percentage is, but a lot of cases when people have things going wrong, they don't consider that there's anything actually wrong with them. There's actually something wrong with you rather than anything with them. So sometimes you have to get to your GP with a little bit of knowledge around what is actually happening in your house, because the GP might, because when we go to GPs, we're often on our best behaviour, saying, yes, I'm fine, I can do this, I can do that. And it's a bit confronting if you've got your partner sitting beside you, well, actually, they don't do that, they don't do that, they don't do that. So to support them, I often say to carers, if you can just write out in point form, because GPs don't want a big long letter, they just want point for about some, what's going wrong. You know, it might be that they're not sleeping at night. They can't remember something 5 minutes before. And when you go to, when that person goes to a GP, the GP may not pick that up straight away. So if you're concerned, then that's how we go to the GP. So GPs start up, that's the process of beginning to get to diagnosis. And they will do a whole raft of things before they send you off to a specialist. If they decide to send you to a specialist, they'll do bloods. CT scan of the brain. So a CT scan of the brain will only show if there's quite major shrinkage of the brain, or if there's a stroke, so an old injury in the brain, or if there's, say, a cancer or some, or a growth in the brain. It won't show the tiny little strokes that I was talking about before. It won't show TIAs or anything like that. So it may be that the doctor goes, all right, well, these things are happening, then we need to send you a specialist who can order what we call an MRI. So that will show more of the blood flow through the brain and the activity of the brain. They'll do a whole raft of blood tests, the B12. They should do the B12. If they don't do the B12, say, can you do B12? So then your GP or the nurse in the GP surgery may have a good idea of where you go from there. But My Aged Care is the next step. That's a 1-800-200-422. This has all the numbers in it, this book here, and I've got a whole lot of information over there if you'd like to take something away with you. Dementia Australia is Australia. It has a 24-hour, 7 days a week, a day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, number that you can call at any time. Say something happens in the middle of the night and you go, my goodness, I don't know what to do with this, then you can call that Dementia Australia helpline. And they have lots of information, and they have also carer counselling if you think that you wanted to speak to someone, you're not sort of comfortable with your caring role, or you're feeling really stressed, and you can get very stressed as a carer. You can. Now, Dementia Advisory and Support Service, which I used, that was one of my jobs in Northern New South Wales. The closest, I actually did some research, and the closest people to here are in Toowoomba, in the Auscare office in Toowoomba, and that's their names, Erin Beatrice and Nikki Phillips. I got in touch with them. They're quite happy for if you wanted to take down that number, if you really have some concerns and you want to speak to someone, they can point you in. They can point you in the right direction of where you need to go, how to access services, what to do. But there is a lot of help out there, but it's just finding it. So, any questions? Was that helpful?
I have a question.
Go.
What do you think it looks like, say you're going into an aged care facility and you know that someone in there has dementia and they're a Christian, what does it look like to encourage them faith-wise?
Good question. I think that for me, going to visit anyone in an aged care facility is to have a little bit of, to try and gather a little bit of past life history. It's really important. You know, if they love to read their Bible, then you're going to get your Bible in there and you're going to do some reading with them, or you just pray, or if they're a person who prayer is really big for them, then I think it's just sitting and maybe holding their hand if they're a touch person and just praying with them. But it is, and you can gather that information from, if you don't particularly know that person, but you're doing some pastoral care or something like that to visit someone, then you can, you're probably going to be able to find some history from family members or from friends or something like that. So that's the sort of thing. And then you might be able to encourage them. Nearly every facility has some sort of service. So it might be that you tap into that or make sure that the nursing staff know that that she would really like to go to that service and make sure that she's there. Or if you've got time, you might go, I'm going to go in for that service and just be with that person. Does that...
Yeah, no, that's good.